morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to our workshop today. We're really excited about this workshop, starting to do really important work, figuring out how Lahontan is going to address the very serious issue of climate change in our region. First, we have just a couple of housekeeping things to do. My name is Amy Horn. I am the chair of the Lahontan Board. I live in Truckee. Let me introduce the other members of the Lahontan Board. And at this end, we have Keith Dias, who is from Rosamond. Eric Sandell is from Truckee. Kimberly Cox, who lives in Hellendale. Over there is... Peter Pumphrey from Chalfont, and unfortunately Don Jardine from Markleyville wasn't able to stay for the meeting this morning. We have Patty Kuyumjin next to me as our executive officer. Can you introduce the staff who's acting as staff this morning?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Thank you. We have a number of our staff in the audience to help be as a resource in these discussions today. Rebecca Phillips is to my left, and she's the board clerk. Lori Kemper is our assistant executive officer. Also in the audience is Cindy Mitten from our Victorville office, Mike Plaziak, our division manager from the Victorville office, Jay Cass, also from the Victorville office. These are all from the Victorville office. John Morales, Gassam Borgasini, Mike Cooney, Mary Delavalle, Patrice Copeland, Jan Zimmerman, Tom Brown, Todd Batty, Christina Velasquez, Omar Pacheco, Bill Muir, Karen Patterson. And now I'm going to shift to our Southland Tahoe office. Doug Smith, who's helping leading this item. Lisa Dernbach. Ann Holden. And Doug Cushman. They're all here to help you, support you in this effort.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is just a small formal part of the meeting, which is public forum, which is an opportunity for anyone to address the Lahontan Board about any matter that is not otherwise on the agenda. And to do that, that's supposed to be just a quick 5-minute presentation. To do that, you hand in one of these orange cards saying your name and how many minutes you need. Since I have no orange cards, I'm assuming nobody wants to address us. Logan, do you really want to address us at public forum?
Well,
Logan really does.
I have exciting news. I'll fill out the little orange card.
Oh, okay. We can do that later. Go ahead.
1 minute.
Good morning. Members of the board. Very exciting news. We opened our bids for our two sub-regional water reclamation plants on Friday. And we received a low bid. We had our financial meeting yesterday. Everything looks good to go, so I believe that we will be issuing the notice to proceed to construct those facilities probably late January, maybe February, but after 22-plus years of planning and effort, we're so close, so close. I just want to let you know that. And thank you for all the support by the regional and by the state board. It's been a wonderful experience.
What level of treatment will those achieve?
Both are tertiary facilities using membrane bioreactors suitable for Title 22 full-body contact.
Great. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Logan, I'll fill out the card for you.
Wow.
Thank you for that exciting news. Okay, with that, the public forum is closed, and we'll move on to the workshop portion of this meeting, which time the board members will all go out and choose a seat somewhere, and we'll turn this meeting over to Doug Smith.
Should we each bring a mic to a table while we're going?
No. We are not bringing mics.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. Can everybody hear me? Yeah, I tend to be kind of on the loud side. Sorry. But if you need this in the back, I'll definitely use it. So thank you for coming. I really appreciate all the turnout. This is excellent. What we're going to do is we have approximately a few hours. Half of this workshop is going to be some presenters providing some information. I know it's going to be hard to see. There are copies of the presentation on the side table back there. And we've got two researchers giving some presentations. Each presentation will be about 15 minutes long. And there will be a little bit of time for some question and answer after each presentation. And then we have some water board staff giving a couple presentations. And the state board staff will talk a little bit, and then our regional board staff will talk just a little bit to set the stage for this exercise. We're here to gather your input on ideas and steps for how the water board deals with climate change. And so it's really important that we hear from you. And we are going to record everything. We'll have small group facilitators at each table. After the presenters present, we'll take a break. And then when everybody comes back, we will randomly assign you to the tables. Bye. There should be a little number on your name tag. Okay? I know that was kind of sneaky of us, but we did that. So we do have a facilitator for the entire workshop. I'm going to facilitate the first part with the presenters, but we have Esther Tracy from State Water Board to help facilitate some questions. There are note cards, large note cards on each table. If you have questions that arise during a presentation, go ahead and jot it down. And then you can ask it at the end. If you didn't get a chance to ask it because time is short, you can hand in your question, and we can help get that answered at break because the researchers will be here to answer some questions. So with that, because time's short, because we really want to spend the time having everybody spend the small group time brainstorming, I want to begin with our first presentation. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Dan Kyan. He's a research meteorologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. Dr. Kyan's special interest in regional climate in California has played a leading role in programs to deliver improved climate information, including climate vulnerability and adaptation assessments to decision makers. Please welcome Dr. Kyan. Thank you. You can probably pull this guy out. It does.
Okay.
I think it's on. I tend to be loud, so.
Thanks, Doug. Okay. Well, good morning. It's a delight to be here, despite the early morning from San Diego. But what I'm going to do is give you sort of an overview of regional climate projections with a focus on water-related issues. And I know that in particular the board and a lot of you are concerned about water quality. I'm going to mostly touch on, I think you would call it water quantity, but it bears on quality, and of course many of you are probably more versed in that area than I am. So, okay, can you all hear me back there? Good. Okay, let's. So, key points here, just to give you a survey of what's to come. First of all, the impacts of climate change are progressive. Greenhouse gases are accumulating in the atmosphere, and as they do, the changes both globally and regionally will expand and increase in their intensity. There's likely to be impacts that are really across the board. Many, many different sectors and physical phenomena will be affected by climate change. Precipitation is a difficult variable to get a fix on. When we look at climate models, there's not a great consensus as far as getting wetter, getting drier. In the southern part of California, if you twisted my arm, I would say that we're likely to get a bit drier than today's climate. But the models are quite undecided about how much and when and so forth. And I would say that much like today's climate, the models are reflecting the fact that there's a lot of variability on timescales ranging from days to decades. So I think in the future we can expect, again, this very volatile climate that we have in California, and we'll look at some of the evidence there. One thing that we do notice in the climate models, and as well as we have seen historically, is the impact on our hydroclimate of a few large storms that either make or break a winter season, essentially a water year. So I think increasingly there's going to be great importance on the delivery of water from large storms. And there's some evidence in models that the largest storms may actually increase in their intensity as they draw on essentially a richer stockpile of water in the atmosphere. Okay, this slide here is a picture of projected temperatures. We use climate models. They're numerical models. They're not unlike the models that are used to predict the weather that you pay attention to in the evening news. But these are essentially tuned to climate processes, and they're carried out for decades, sometimes centuries. And we use those as a lens to look into the future. They're driven by assumed changes in greenhouse gas forcing and other aspects of atmospheric forcing. As we move into the future, the chart here shows both historical climate and future climate from a swarm of these models. We use several models. Nowadays there's actually more than 40 models that are contributing to the International Global Climate Assessment, the IPCC. And in this case, what we're looking at is 14 of these models. And in this case, there's three different assumed emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, pathways that are represented here. The red one is the higher end emissions, so-called RCP 8.5, which means 8.5 watts per square meter of radiative imbalance by the end of the 21st century. The middle pathway is more of a moderate emissions pathway. It's not the one that we are on right now internationally. So hopefully activities that will be organized will reduce emissions. And then the blue one is more of an environmentally friendly, optimistic emissions pathway. What you notice here, this is the year 2000, and then we're going out to the end of the century. All the spaghetti is individual models. The dark lines are the median of 14 model simulations as we go forward. What you see is that the the different policies really don't matter too much in the short term, but in the long term, as greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere, there's more and more dependence on, in this case, this is a July temperature extracted from these models from an area over Sacramento. You can see that they start to diverge by about 2040, which is a year that was mentioned in the handout that we're looking at. The other thing is, of course, there's lots of variability from year to year, not unlike today. And another thing to take note of here is this is today's climate, this level right here, and I've dotted in 3 degrees Celsius of increase for July. 3 degrees of change has been noted by some climate researchers as a so-called dangerous level of temperature increase. This is 3 degrees averaged over an entire July period, so it's a 24/7 value. It doesn't sound like that much. 3 degrees Celsius, by the way, is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's quite perceptible, and we can see that at least the top two of these climate scenarios begin to cross that 3 degrees Celsius plateau by mid to later part of the present century. Another thing that to note is climate models are run not only prospectively forward in time, they're run retrospectively, and the models correctly indicate the tendency that we've already seen in observations for temperatures to rise, the rise beginning sometime in the late 70s or so. Okay, so I wanted to give you a little portrait of the changes that the models are looking towards as we go forward in time. I'm going to show you three different time slices, what you might call early 21st century. This is 2010 to 2039. In this case, I've got 31 models. This is the higher end scenario. This chart depicts wetter going is vertically above this zero level right here, or drier is below. So wetter and drier relative to a present day climatology of 30 years average. And then as we go to the right here, that's representing how much warmer it is. So we're looking at the changes in temperature along the x-axis and precipitation along the y-axis in this chart. And you can see that, again, the models are kind of undecided. Some of them getting wetter, and probably more than half of them getting drier. This is taken from a representative area in these models that you could think of as Los Angeles. So that's the early part of the century. And by the way, zero would be today's climate. So you can see, in this case, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. This is the middle part of the century, so 2040 through 2069. You can see all the solutions are moving to the right. We're getting warmer. Again, undecided as far as how much precipitation change there is. And by the end of the century, we're getting warmer still. And again, though, what you might say is somewhat undecided, but sort of a disquieting number of the models are getting a bit drier here. Okay. Snowpack, of course, is an important water reservoir for California, and particularly for the eastern Sierra, and I assume a lot of the Lahontan area. And not surprisingly, as we move into the future, we're seeing changes in the California snowpack. This is the Sierra Nevada here, this long feature. You can recognize the geography. The Coast Ranges are here. We're color-coding all the areas on these charts that that traditionally get snow. And again, we're showing early, middle, and later part of the 21st century. These are 30-year averages. The red shading is this is a fraction of the today's normal snowpack, and this is the snowpack derived in the springtime, recorded as snow water equivalent. And what we see is by the middle part of the century, we've lost about a third of the present day snow water equivalent stored in the snowpack. Doesn't mean we've lost water, it just means that it's not stored as snow. And by the end of the century, under this particular model, we've lost a little more than half. The red shading shows how snow starts to erode at the edges or the lower elevations, and then it moves higher up into the range as we go into the future. If we look at this not from one particular model, but from a swarm of models, in this case, we have 32 different model simulations, and we ask the question, how likely is it that we achieve median of today's snowpack? The odds of getting what you might call a normal year diminishes over time. Towards the end of the century, that's only about a 1 in 10 likelihood. In today's climate, of course, it's 1 of 2. Okay, next up. And then you can ask the question of the odds of a very low snowpack, similar to what we derived this year. And those odds, of course, climb over time, so that if we use the 10 percentile marker, by the end of the century, we're seeing that 4 years out of 10 instead of 1 year out of 10. Drier landscapes, if we look at soil moisture, again, early, middle, and later part of the 21st century, this is a hydrological model calculation, and we're looking at the June soil moisture content here. And you can see this is really a west-wide phenomena, that our landscapes are going to be drying earlier. Wildfire, of course, is an issue, especially with this earlier drying, there's an interesting part of the resources that were distributed talking about the wildfire problem. We know from looking at climate data that a lot of the larger wildfires in the last 40 years have been in years where we've had early springs, early snow melt, lower snowpacks. That's what this chart shows, late snow melt years compared to early snow melt years. We've seen over the West about a six-fold increase in acres burned from the mid-1980s forward relative to a 15-year period earlier than that, where springs and summers have been warmer. We continue. This is an observed precipitation record that you could think of representing this region here. Of course, this last 3 years have been exceedingly dry. This volatility, as I mentioned at the onset, is going to stay with us, we think. Droughts, of course, accumulate over many years. This over the last 15 years, these red dots here represent deficits of approximately 2 years of a normal year's water supply. So we've really been suffering shortfalls in the in the last year periods. We've seen the water, the loss of water in the West by a variety of measures. One of them is looking at GPS sensors, and actually not in areas that are pumping groundwater, but other areas we're actually seeing the crust of the earth lift as the weight of water is no longer there. So we've seen about a 4 millimeter increase in ground levels that reflects essentially a 10 centimeter or call it about 3 inches, 3 to 4 inches of water loss over the entire West. In the Sierras, we've seen actually much more than that, something like 50 centimeters of water loss in this last year relative to an earlier baseline. It turns out that the variability of our precipitation here from year to year in California is dictated very strongly by just a handful of large storms. And we think in the future that dependence on the really big events is going to be probably even more acute than what we've seen in the future. I've run out of my 15 minutes. The one thing I do want to mention, the implications: less snow, more rain, earlier runoff from snow-fed, or at least traditionally snow-fed watersheds, probably higher floods in certain areas where snow lines are higher, and potentially there's a concern about how we're going to store all this early water that's coming off, because of course our reservoirs are generally not only water storage vessels, but they're flood protection facilities. And as far as water quality, I think some implications. Well, warmer surface waters as the climate warms. Warmer dry spells, which means that when we have less water, it's going to be suffering from very warm temperatures. Occasionally high runoff, which probably will result in greater sediment influx, and in some cases with very possibly increased burned landscapes, there's those barren landscapes to be concerned about as far as the runoff contribution. So that's it. And Doug, I hope I didn't abuse that too badly.
Excellent. So we have just a minute or two for some questions, if anybody has any questions of Dr. Kyan.
When you're referring to stored water, are you talking about man-made facilities or lakes and aquifers?
I'm talking about runoff from natural landscapes. So,
as far as where they're stored at.
Oh, I heard storm and you said stored. Give me the context of the stored water.
Well, you're talking about potentially less stored water. Are you referring to storage in reservoirs? Are you talking about storage in aquifers or natural lakes?
Yeah, I think particularly built storage because of the flood protection aspect of the problem. We're going to have to contend with the fact that runoff is coming during the season where we get a lot of storms, so we can't just fill up, at least in certain years. This year that wouldn't be a problem because they're all empty, but other years there will be that issue. So, yeah.
If your slide with the snowpack was based on research that got published in 2002, have you gotten back into looking at the information since that time, and have those values of reductions changed?
Will you repeat that question?
Laura.
Lauma,
excuse me. Is referring to some earlier work that Noah Knowles and I did back in the early 2000s, which actually was that three-portrait picture of the snowpack was based upon. And that was one where by the end of the century, we lost about half of the California spring snowpack. The later picture where we showed the ensemble of 32 different simulations is more recent, and it essentially confirms what we saw earlier, but in general, the earlier picture is probably a little optimistic. The higher end models, as far as how much reduction in spring snowpack we might expect, are approaching two-thirds of snow loss rather than a half. So our calculations are that approximately every degree Celsius of increase is going to incur more than 20% loss of the present day spring snowpack accumulated over California.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Perfect.
Since you show basically an average precipitation projection of zero, and but we're losing groundwater, that implies that we're losing it up to the ocean, right? It's running off. Is that a fair assessment? Because there's the physical capture in reservoirs, but there's also the potential capture in the ground.
Yes. So one of the questions is we're losing groundwater.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Thanks, Doug. The question was where is the deficit in water going if we're losing groundwater? And one assertion was that it's running into the ocean. Part of that is true from natural runoff processes, but also as we use water for irrigation, which of course is a tremendous source of groundwater extraction, we're essentially putting that water in the atmosphere, and then it's fluxing away. So one of the challenges is how to recharge aquifers and so forth in the future, where we have perhaps a flashier climate, where we don't have as much residence of wet soils on the landscape, and so forth. So there's that challenge coming into the future, I think.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Kyan. So our next presenter is Dr. John Isbicki. He's worked for the U.S. Geological Survey for more than 30 years in Maryland, Massachusetts, and California. Within California, his studies have focused on understanding the physical hydrology of coastal and desert aquifer systems, primarily through the application of chemical and isotopic tracers. Please welcome Dr. Isbicki.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And the tenor or content of this talk will be a little bit different than what Dan had, and this is very much an applied talk. And my wife looked at this last night, and she goes, what are you talking about? Are you doing an experiment out there? Are you going to put some heaters out there and change the climate of the Mojave Desert? And no, that's not the point of the title. The point of the title is you have to deal with very practical issues and make very practical decisions on very local. Climate change is a very broad regional thing that's occurring throughout the world at this point in time. As part of your challenge and your needs to make decisions and make appropriate decisions, you have to be able to understand what's actually happening in the world around you today in terms of the natural variability of the system that you live in and work in. The Mojave Desert is, by its nature, a place of extremes and highly variable. You have to be able to apply that understanding with the background of what man has already done on the local scale that's happening within the Mojave Desert, the issues that you have to deal with. And you have to recognize what these changes are, natural, what the local scale changes are, and occurring against this broad-scale background that's happening in the world today. And so from that standpoint, it is very applied. I was asked to talk a little bit about sustainability And there was a lot of concern on the part of the regional board, as you know, they know I have some involvement coming up in the Hinckley groundwater remediation, so they asked if I could speak specifically about that issue in terms of groundwater sustainability, recharge, and climate change. And it's not my point here to speak for the people who are working on developing remediation plans for that site. I know I've talked to them, and I know that they have expressed concern and are aware of the need for sustainability of any plan that they come up with, and a desire to make sure that it works in the long term in terms of changing climate and in terms of what's actually out there today. But it would give some background to the board and to the members here and their staff in terms of sort of the decisions that they have to work with and what's happening out there at present, and how to recognize natural change, how to recognize man-made change from other sources, and what's going on in the environment with climate change. And so that's what I mean by applied climate change and sustainability. The Hinckley issue makes maybe a nice framework where I can point to a very specific location in the Mojave Desert. I can talk about very specific changes that might be occurring there within the broader spectrum of the hydrology of the desert. And it's my hope that maybe that'll provide some sort of framework for this discussion that's going to follow, so that you can ask very specific questions about what about my area, how does my area differ, how does recharge occur at this location relative to that location. This is a picture of the Mojave River in 1993. It's the first flow of the very wet season that occurred in January there. And the river had not flowed, this is near Linwood, had not flowed at that location since 1983. So it had been about 10 years. We're at the leading edge of the storm pulse as it comes down there. Ultimately, that was the flow of record at the Upper Narrows and the headwaters there, less so at Barstow. And you can see sheet flow across the old channel. The channel was extraordinarily dry, 10 years since there was any flow at that location. The water was infiltrating very, very rapidly at that point in time. You could actually hear it. It made a roar, low, roaring, rumbling noise as the air was displaced from the subsurface as the water moved into the ground. And it worked well for you. And
thank
you.
It's
been
there.
Ah, okay.
Just variance.
Okay. And push the wrong button. And here it is, just a brief period of time later, I don't know exactly how long. Somehow I ended up on the wrong side of the river, which is probably, happens to me more often than one might think. But the stream came up very, very quickly, a lot of water. And as I said, this was the flow of record for the Mojave River at the Upper Narrows, at the West Fork at Deep Creek. Less so at Barstow, but it was a lot of flow. It was probably the recharge event of record for the Mojave system. This is just kind of a cartoon sort of capturing some of the plans, not all the plans, but some of the plans that are on the table and being discussed for remediation at Hinckley. And one of them is to pump contaminated groundwater containing chromium, put it on alfalfa fields, and infiltrate that water into the ground. And the redox conditions within the soil will reduce the chrome 6 to chrome 3, pretty effective treatment plan. The issue that revolves around that is sustainability. And it requires groundwater to be available to pump. And it's not merely just a matter of securing water rights. It's a matter of ensuring that there's physical wet water in the ground for supply and pumpage to maintain a system like that. And that's really what the regional board, the staff at PG&E, have to decide on in terms of what's appropriate, what will work, and how far into the future this can be sustained under varying conditions that might happen in the future. And what you're looking at right here is, here's the compressor station down here, the Mojave River is just to the south of that. The plume is within this area here, and those green areas are proposed agricultural fields that will be managed in this fashion. As I said, they require water. As Dan had mentioned, there's going to be a climate change perhaps in the Mojave Desert that may or may not include some change in the water availability. Right now in the Barstow area in Hinckley Valley, you're getting about 150 millimeters per year of annual precipitation. If you change that 10 or 20%, it may have a very, very large effect on the biota and the animals and the plants that are there. But under that environmental condition, there is no aerial recharge that's occurring. So natural recharge from precipitation really won't be affected because it's already a zero, and it'll probably stay there even if you double the amount of rainfall that was occurring in that area. So all that water that's being proposed in this location for sustainable remediation is coming from the Mojave River. And you saw some pictures of it earlier. What we're looking at here is a map of the Mojave River groundwater basin. The green color that you see here is variations in delta deuterium. Delta deuterium is a stable isotope of hydrogen. It exists naturally within the water molecule H2O. What it has is one additional neutron compared to the more abundant hydrogen atom. And believe it or not, that's something that can be measured very precisely. And believe it or not, that's actually something that very greatly affects, in a measurable fashion, the behavior of water in the environment. And without going through the physics of it and what's actually happening, at the higher altitudes of the mountain peaks in the San Gabriels and San Bernardinos, we have less of the heavy isotope. And that water is referred to as isotopically lighter. And these are numbers that on that graph are the minus 80, minus 90, minus 70 or 80 per mil range that we're looking at. Water that condenses and falls as precipitation at the lower altitudes is what we refer to as isotopically heavier. In this case, this minus 60 type number is slightly heavier than that. Much of the precipitation that gives rise to stream flow in the Mojave River is actually storms that occur in the vicinity of Cajon Pass at this low altitude here. Same sort of thing happens in the vicinity of San Gregorio Pass to the south. And it's those large, extreme events that generate flow in the Mojave River. And you can see this makes a feature that we can measure that extends out along the floodplain aquifer of the Mojave River, out more than 100 miles into the desert. The Hinckley Valley area is located here. Victorville located about there, Barstow located in that area there. Again, similar effects down here in the San Gregorio Pass. And we can look at that, we can measure that, we can understand where that water came from and how it got into the system. And what I want to point out to you is that in the Hinckley area, we can be pretty assured that all the water that's in the groundwater system there, all the water that will be available for planned remediation activities in that area, originated as infiltration of storm flows from the Mojave River, like I saw in those first two photographs. And the same applies actually down here in Mojave Valley, too. That's all originated from the Mojave River. And how did it get there, and when did it get there, and at what frequency? Tritium is another isotope of hydrogen. It has three neutrons in this case. It's unstable. It means it's radioactive, and it decays at a known rate. That rate has a half-life of about 12.3 years. Given the natural background of tritium, what we're looking at here is the recharge that has occurred from infiltration of storm flows in the Mojave River since about 1950, about the last 60 or so years. If you look at groundwater water budgets constructed for the area under pre-development conditions, that would be about 45,000 acre feet per year. Under conditions that occurred between 1930 and 1990, on average, and use that term cautiously because on average is actually a term that really doesn't apply well to California hydrology. It's a little bit higher, about 77,000 acre feet. And the reason for that is agricultural development in the basin, municipal development in the basin, pulled water down, made storage available along the Mojave River, and a lot of that water infiltrated before it could get down to lower reaches. It's actually, that's what drove the adjudication in the Mojave Basin during the 1990s, is that downstream users sued upstream users because their water rights were being impaired by the inability of large stream flows to make it down the Mojave River and recharge their aquifer systems. Wow, only 5 minutes left. So you hear a lot about water availability in the desert. If you don't see a feature that looks like this, you don't have 50 to 70,000 acre feet of groundwater recharge per year. Over the longer scale, we can use carbon-14 to look at that. It has a longer half-life, 5,730 years. Again, you can see the same feature along the Mojave River. You can see recharge occurring at the front of the San Gabriel Mountains. Again, some recharge over here down near San Gregorio Pass, near the high fans on the San Bernardino Mountains, Cushing Berry Creek in that area. The same general features. And that's what this recharge process looks like over many thousands of years out in the Mojave Desert. And again, sustaining all the flow, all the groundwater that's pumped in that area with actually fairly recent water extending all the way out to Harper Lake. Take a look at this area here in the southern part of the Mojave Desert area, and that's Pipes Wash. It actually feeds the flow system near Surprise Springs, which is the water supply for the Marine Corps base in that area. And I was asked to comment about climate change and how it might affect water quality. And over the scale of the past 5,000 or so years here, recharge in Pipes Wash, which is about 600 feet annually, 600 acre feet annually in present day conditions, decreased from what it was in the past by maybe about 60 or so percent. And there were changes in water quality associated with that. Chloride concentrations increased from about 16 to about 26 milligrams per liter, really as a result of desiccation of the system that was going on there. Dissolved solids increased from about 170 to 310 milligrams per liter. But if you put that in perspective, water that's being imported into the basin right now to manage the basin as part of the adjudication goes through the Delta in Northern California, has a chloride concentration of 100 milligrams per liter and dissolved solid concentrations in excess of this. So these changes are relatively small compared to imported water quality, compared to changes that one might see from irrigation return flows, and compared to changes that one might see from sewage discharges into the river. So you have to keep that in perspective. You have to understand what's happening with these processes and how they work. This is water level rises along the Mojave River, and this is a result of those pictures that I had at the beginning of the slide in 1993 in that flow event of record. And what we can see at Hinckley is that we had water level rises of greater than 48 feet. In the Victorville area, some of the water level rises as a result of that single season, that single event, were more than 90 feet. Very, very rapid. Here's a typical hydrograph from the upper part of the river. In the floodplain aquifer, you can see very rapid responses to flow that occurs in the river within a single season. The regional aquifer, where groundwater was older, removed from the sources of recharge, declines as pumpage continues because it's isolated from sources of recharge and it isn't readily recharged by surface flows in the Mojave River. This is the Hinckley area again, the compressor station down near here, the Mojave River in this area here. I want you to look at three wells stacked sort of in this area here to give you an idea of how water moves through the system once it's recharged. And then we'll look at another well out of the floodplain aquifer in the alluvial fan deposits there. Here's flow at the Barstow gauge, 1993-2005. What you can see is a lag between when the recharge occurs and when we see the signal propagating in the well. It just takes time for water to move certain distances. Further away you get, the longer the time. You move far enough away, there's certainly general responses in terms of recharges occurring out there, but other land use effects, manipulations of the system for agriculture, manipulations of the system to control the plume begin to dominate, and you see these less readily. Take a look here along the alluvial fans. It's actually much closer to the river than what those other wells were, but it's in a more poorly permeable deposits. You really don't see any response to recharge in those areas. This is a flow duration curve, and what we're looking at here is time in percentage of time. Flow of a given value on this axis is exceeded. And what I'm showing you here are three graphs, three data sets from the gauge at Victorville, at Afton Canyon, and at Barstow. The first thing that you should notice is that there's always flow at Victorville. There's almost always flow at Afton Canyon. And Barstow, flow occurs only infrequently. The other thing I want you to see on this graph is the difference between the dashed lines and the solid lines. The dashed lines represent flow in the early parts of this period of record. The solid line represents flow in the latter parts of the period record that are really affected by man's activities within the basin and agricultural and municipal pumping. And you see big differences, particularly on the low end at Victorville, somewhat at Afton Canyon, and throughout the flow regime are Barstow. And as I mentioned earlier, this is what actually drove the adjudication that occurred in the 1990s out in this basin. And you see it very clearly here on the low end of the flows. If you look at the high end of the flows, we've got the same information, same style of presentation here, but this is the headwaters here, and now we're looking at annual flows in acre feet, 1,000 to 500,000. Again, recurrence interval, same thing, just the inverse of the percent exceedance that I just had earlier. And I mentioned earlier that 1993 was a flood of record. There you can see it right here, the highest flow of the Narrows, almost 500,000 acre-feet of water going in at that point. The next highest, 1978, 1969, 1980, 1983 here. Look at the difference at Barstow. 1993, the most water ever coming in the system, is not the largest flow. And that's an effect of man. That's the effect of our development in the basin, lowering water levels, increasing the ability of water to infiltrate from the river and not travel as far down into the basin. 1938, which is actually the flood of record at Barstow, is actually only the fourth or fifth largest flow recorded in the basin. So there's big differences as a result of man. And take a look at what's happened in recent years. The flow at 2005 was actually the second largest flow of record. And actually, it does appear that it's had a proportionate response at Barstow, largely because of the adjudication, and one could argue because of the management that's occurred within the basin to make sure that it's full and water can flow across there. So we have an effect of man that's been mitigated by management in the basin, a very careful and hard work by some of the local water agencies. But what if, as a result of climate change, water is not available for importation within the basin? We could actually revert as a secondary climatic effect to conditions that prevailed within the basin during the late 70s, just because you can't manage the basin in the fashion that you did previously. So these are things you have to consider, not just losses of precipitation, not just increased dryness from warmer temperatures. The Mojave, as I mentioned before, flows by extreme flows and could in fact actually have larger flows, greater magnitude flows at increasing frequency, but if because of secondary effects that go on within the basin and development competition for water, it could actually produce less recharge under those conditions than what we might expect. And regardless of what happens with climate change, we have to make actual practical decisions. And one way to do it is assume stationarity. Maybe it's not always the best. But in this case, if you assume the climate isn't changing, what do you have to be prepared for? In this case, the historical record shows us that the Mojave River at Barstow, flow and recharge that occurs from that, it can be 20 years with no flow, no significant flow in that river. So the last flow occurred in 2010. I would like to think that in 2030, we could be sitting in a room like this talking about the success and merits of what was done today and decided today in the light of climate change, not arguing and discussing about, well, we failed because we didn't correctly anticipate climate change. Knowledge of the past, even assuming stationarity and including understanding what this extreme event means in terms of drought, understanding what extreme events mean in terms of flow of water and its availability, is going to be really, really important to the decision-making process as part of the understanding of climate change. So just quick conclusions. I didn't go into this a whole lot. I removed some of the slides about that. But climate in the Mojave Desert has been changing for millennia. It's not static. It has never really been static. We talked a little bit about desiccation and the changes of water quality in Surprise Springs. But there's uncertainty as to long-term climate change that one can expect. And Dan hit on that a little bit. If we have change in precipitation in the Mojave Desert, it may not greatly affect water supply. It could greatly affect the flora and fauna in the desert. If we have an increased frequency and magnitude of the storms at Cajon Pass, it may greatly affect water supply. It may actually make the desert have increased recharge, even though there's less precipitation and it's a drier climate. But other man-made influences that we can't predict that are happening elsewhere across the state that affect water supply and availability may affect that and partially mitigate that, may mitigate some of the management activities that are being done currently to make sure that we have water supply available in the future. But in the absence of anything, you know, being aware of what the extremes in the system are now and that you can expect as long as 20 years with no significant flow and recharge in the Mojave River at the location near Barstow, becomes an important decision-making criteria for the board, for water managers out here, for your staff in terms of
what they need to be prepared for, so that in 2030 we're talking success stories and not talking if only we had thought ahead. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to address them. Yeah.
There's a mic coming around. It'll help the folks in the back.
One of the concerns about the groundwater pumping under drought conditions is the potential for reducing the ability of the soil to recapture water when you have natural rainfall. In your studies, are you able to make any statements about that potential or that concern?
I haven't really looked directly at that in my studies, and I really can't address that question. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lipsky. So we have two more presentations. Our next presenter is Max Gomberg. Max is the climate change advisor to the State Water Resources Control Board, where he's helped to develop emergency water conservation regulations, among other initiatives. He's also a member of the water energy team of the state's climate action team, WETCAT for short, and was the lead author for the water section of the AB 32 scoping plan update. So please welcome Max Gomberg.
Thanks, Doug. Morning, everyone. As Doug mentioned, I work for the State Water Board, and I'm the first person that the board has ever hired to do climate change full-time. And, in fact, my position is funded by our state's climate law, monies collected under it, under AB 32. There are a few of us around agencies outside of the state's Air Board, which is primarily charged with implementing that law, that do climate work. So I'm going to talk about, you know, what we're doing at the state level on climate broadly, particularly on adapting to these changes, because as you saw from Dan's presentation, regardless of what we do in the near term, regardless of how successful, for example, the accord signed by the U.S. and China yesterday on reducing emissions is, we are still going to be experiencing changes in climate in all the ways that you've heard about. So one thing that we've done over the last few years at the state level is we've produced a lot of plans. They cover all aspects of sort of general water management, response to climate change, reducing the impact of greenhouse gas emissions from how we manage water in the state. So I just want to make a couple comments about these plans. The Water Action Plan, the first one you see up there, that's the governor's plan for sort of 5 years of focused policy responses for water management, somewhat in the context of climate change, but more just in the context of we have an ecological crisis in the Delta. We're dealing with a drought right now. We need more conservation. We need ecological restoration. We need better flood management. We need a number of things, irrespective of climate change. So that's mainly what's in that plan. And then we have our two sort of core climate plans. The AB 32 plan is designed looking at policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, primarily in the energy and transportation sectors. But, you know, water has a piece since we use a lot of energy to pump and treat and move water around. And then the safeguarding plan is the state's adaptation plan. And the first adaptation plan was done in 2009 under the prior administration. This is the update to that plan. And it has a fairly large and extensive water section that was a multi-agency collaboration led by the state's Department of Water Resources. What I want to say about these plans is there are a lot of them. It's a lot of pages. The safeguarding plan is 300 pages long. However, we do look to these plans when we're trying to figure out what to do at the state level, from a regulatory perspective, from a legislative perspective, and other policymaking mechanisms we have, such as how we distribute grant and loan money. So these plans matter. Another thing we've done at the state level is we've put out a lot of guidance documents, and we've funded some research. So we're on to what's known now as the fourth in a series of statewide climate assessments that the state funds. And it funds academics and researchers from across the state to look at aspects of climate change across all sectors of the economy. So from agriculture to water to energy to transportation to, land use and forests and on. And so we're currently in the midst of receiving proposals for the fourth assessment. It's $5 million for across all sectors of the economy, and the focus this time around is really sort of cross-sector research. Instead of just looking at impacts on power plants, for example, that are situated in high-risk areas, say along the coast, the idea would be to look at an integrated sort of infrastructure risk assessment, and all of these models, to refine them for different parts of the state, because as has been mentioned, these models are global models. What matters is what's happening in local regions, and there's still a lot of work to be done on trying to rein in the probability ranges for localized regions. So we've done that. We've put together some guidance. I think on all your tables you have copies of our adaptation policy guidance, which again is sort of the state's one big guidance document to local entities, particularly local governments, on what can be done for responding to climate change in a way that is beneficial for everyone involved and sort of causes the least pain, if you will. A couple other things we're doing. We are updating the general plan guidelines for all local jurisdictions, so cities and counties, for the first time since 2003, with a real focus on how municipalities in particular can take steps to ensure that their populations and their infrastructure is less vulnerable to all of the changes we're going to see, from the floods to the droughts to the extreme heat and the forest fires and beyond. And then, I just want to mention briefly, the federal government is also involved. You often hear, we have no federal climate policy. Well, it's true, there's been no legislation passed by Congress, but the Obama administration has basically, by executive order, directed its agencies to really work on what they call resilience, which is essentially, adapting to climate change. So a lot of the federal agencies, from the Forest Service to the Department of Energy to the Bureau of Reclamation, they don't have a lot of money, but they do have sort of technical support that they're making available to states, native tribes and local governments on various adaptation initiatives. So there are a lot of challenges with adaptation. For mitigating climate change, for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we have money. We have a cap and trade system, and we're collecting money to spend on various initiatives, again, mostly in the transportation and electric sectors, because that's where the majority of the state's emissions originate from. On adaptation, we don't have a sort of centralized funding source. It's diffuse, it's not as focused. When the focus on mitigating climate change is reducing emissions, so we know where the emissions come from. On adaptation, we're dealing with the whole range of effects that we're experiencing that are going to become more severe as we go forward, and you saw that in the prior two presentations. As we move out towards 2100, we're losing the snowpack at a greater and greater rate, and we're going to have likely more extreme forest fires, more extreme heat days, particularly in inland areas, in Southern California, and a host of other effects. And so adapting to all of these requires sort of different types of responses. So it's a funding challenge sort of across all sectors and all levels of government. And we don't do funding for adaptation in a sort of integrated way. We have pots of money. This pot of money is for fixing roads, and this pot of money is for energy infrastructure, and this pot of money is for ag. We don't put it together very well, and it's something we're trying to work on at the state level. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then what you saw in the first two presentations is what we know is the general trend, speaking broadly. The variation, the potential, for more precipitation or less precipitation, how many years are we going to have big floods versus longer stretches of drought? We don't know. And so, regulatory agencies such as the water boards have trouble. It's very difficult to put standards in place when you really don't know what the conditions are going to be. And so that's a challenge we're really trying to address across state government is, our whole regulatory framework is basically based on static conditions. We now have to have a regulatory framework that looks out and says, if to take an example that's not germane to this area, if the sea level rises, 5 feet in the next 80-odd years, that probably means we have to take a whole separate set of responses than if it only rises 3 feet. We don't know how much it's going to rise. It in part depends on how much carbon we keep pumping out into the atmosphere globally. So, dealing with this uncertainty in our regulatory processes is really tough. And while we've put out, planning guidances and such, no one has developed a guidance or sort of set of best practices for sort of the state and federal government regulatory policy making approach to responding to climate change, and so it's something that we're trying to work with all the regions now on how do we do that. It's an ongoing discussion. I mentioned funding earlier. We don't have a sort of sustained funding source, but the stuff, a lot of the adaptive measures we need to take are going to cost money. So what you see up here in this triangle, this is sort of one of my favorites from when I was young and I was watching a home improvement show. Contractor, comes in to the house and the family says, we want all of the kitchen redone and can you do it so that it's cheap and can you do it good quality and please do it fast. Contractor says, you get 2 out of 3. You want it done at low cost? Well, you're going to lose on quality. But I can do it fastly and cheaply, but you lose on quality, right? If you want it done well and you want it done fast, it's going to cost you. Well, what we're trying to do now with adaptation really is put all three together, right? We're trying to strike that balance because, some of these effects, such as losing the Sierra snowpack and sea level rise, they're sort of slow-moving disasters. Really, the time for action is now, and the cost for dealing with these things needs to be sort of dealt with sooner rather than later, because the longer we wait, the more it's going to cost when we have to deal with the disasters. That's a big challenge. So, this year we're in a drought. Drought is not new to California, but this is a particularly severe drought. We don't know how much longer it's going to go on. And what you can see up there is the state has taken a wide variety of actions to respond to this drought, which are, helping with our response. There's only really one of those things listed up there that's going to help in the long term for the future droughts, and that's the groundwater management legislation, because ultimately, we're losing, our best reservoir, which is the snowpack. Our next best reservoir is groundwater basins around the state, and if they're depleted, then we're really in trouble. Our surface water reservoirs are simply not going to get a state of 38 million people and growing in a overall changed and potentially drier climate through with the level of water use and economic activity we see now. It's simply not going to be possible. So the other thing that really matters is how all this money gets spent. So in this election, we just approved a $7.5 billion bond. There's a lot in it. This is one slide of what's in it, and then here's the rest of what's in it. It's a lot, and it could go towards a lot of good programs. But what really matters is how this money gets spent. Is it getting spent in a way that's perpetuating, you know, our vulnerability to these climatic changes, or is it getting spent in a way that's really reducing risk? I mentioned, you know, the links between water and energy and climate. This is a lot of the work I do. We are trying at the state level to sort of coordinate our actions. It really matters, right? When we do groundwater management, if we do a better job of that, we're going to spend less energy pumping water from deeper out of the ground. That also then helps reduce the impact of our energy use on emissions. So, you know, we're trying to coordinate. Now, we've responded to this drought, but we've done it in a reactive way. You know, the best way to respond to the drought is to be prepared for the drought before it happens. And we know there are going to be future droughts. We have to do a better job of being prepared, because otherwise, you know, it's just going to get worse as we move forward in time. You know, one thing we've seen from Australia's experience, which lasted over 10 years, is, you know, sometimes once you get people sort of in the habit, once we all change our behaviors to take out the lawns and, you know, put in the efficient appliances, you know, that can become permanent change. So this is what it looked like in August, which was a month after the State Board passed our emergency water conservation regulation. You can see the different regions of the state here. So you can see, you know, most of the water used in the state is in Southern California. This is the percentage reduction. This line was the statewide average, which was about 11.5%. You can see this region here at almost 10%. So it's been a good response. We need more. You've probably seen something like this. It hasn't changed all that much since August. You know, this is not extreme. This is exceptional drought. Dan talked about wildfires. You know, in closing, I just want to say, you know, one of the most critical elements of our response, you know, as a state and as a population to climate change and the impacts of climate change is really looking out for the communities that are already the most vulnerable, which tend to be the more already disadvantaged communities in the state. The worst impacts we're seeing from this drought are in the Central Valley, because that's where people are literally running out of water. There are already a lot of communities where we have water quality problems, where people didn't have access to safe water to begin with, and now we've got people whose wells are literally going dry. This is really not something that should be acceptable in a state with, you know, one of the world's largest economies. But this is what we're dealing with. So, you know, one change that was made this year is the drinking water program, which funds, you know, critical infrastructure for small community water systems, was moved from the state's Department of Health over to the Water Board. The idea being that we already administer the money for clean water for our wastewater infrastructure, and hopefully we can get it out the door more quickly, and we can get more communities this critical infrastructure so that they have water and it's clean and safe to drink. So with that, I'll close, and happy to take any questions.
Uh,
I'm going to ask a really sensitive question. Is anybody stepping back and looking at, if we continue the business as usual process, at what point does our Western society begin to break down under the costs of not only adaptation, but the disaster recovery? I mean, I'm from a town that darn near burned down. It cost millions of dollars for the fire protection on it. And this is a community of less than 1,000 people. We can't afford to continue to do that kind of thing before the whole system breaks down. I'm just wondering if anybody is looking at that.
I think there are a lot of people who think about it on a very frequent basis and are thinking about ways, you know, under the structures that we have in society to do something about it, and thinking about new structures. You know, we've been, even in this country, we've been hit with a number of very large-scale disasters recently. We had Hurricane Katrina. We had Superstorm Sandy. You know, we're having an incredibly intense drought in the West, and in California in particular. So, you know, the scientific community has been sort of beating on this drum for a long time. The policy community moves more slowly because, you know, there are interests, you know, that conflict with moving quickly in our economic system. But it's not that no one's thinking about these questions. It's just that it's difficult to move quickly. In one sense, because really we're a reactive species. Right? We're good after the disaster hits. We're not so good about being proactive before.
Yeah.
Working on the premise of reduced snowpack and increased wildfire risk, and hearing you having said that transportation and the energy sector are the primary carbon contributors currently, I heard, and this is unsubstantiated, that the U.S. Forest Service, without knocking on them, is trending from being a carbon sequester to a carbon emitter based on wildfires occurring on their lands. How does wildfire emission rank along those lines of the energy sector or the transportation sector and the responsibility for the state to, and for the population to deal with that issue? Where is wildfire on that list of emissions? Do you know?
So I don't know where wildfire is on the list of emissions. I know that there's a long set of actions, at least at the state level, and of course the state doesn't have jurisdiction over most of the forest land in the state, dealing with wildfire. You know, when you get the worst effects, right, because you've got an understory that's sort of grown out of control, and when you have that fire sweep through, then, you know, it reaches the canopy and you get, you know, these catastrophic fires like the Rim Fire. That we saw. And of course, you know, for water supply and quality, the after effect of that can also be catastrophic, because if you have a large area that burns completely, you get a large storm in the winter after that, all that sediment flows down, wreaks havoc, and it also reduces our reservoir capacity because that's where it generally ends up. But I don't know. Maybe someone else knows. I'm not seeing anyone nodding about the carbon emissions, so I can't speak to that.
Okay, last question.
Last question. Thank you. So I hazard a guess that there are a lot of engineers in the room, and that engineers want to do something. But I'm wondering, are there opportunities to save money by protecting ecological services that are out there right now that we should be thinking about?
That's a very large question. sure. I mean, the way we save money is by not having to spend money, you know, to correct things when things go horribly wrong. And the first example that springs to mind, and this is less of an ecological spin on it, but you know, you may have read about or seen a few weeks back there was a huge main burst in LA, flooded the UCLA campus. When we don't maintain the infrastructure we have, dealing with to consequences of that infrastructure failing can often be not only costly but also have ecological effects. So I think it's really about you know, we have to invest now, and that's actually how we'll realize the cost savings sort of down the road.
Can I follow up that question? If it's quick, real quick, but there's consequences from an operational standpoint of digging up streets. There's a myriad of paperwork involved with that. So there's not a quick fix to even doing that. Just the regulatory compliance that's needed to say, I'm going to replace 2 miles of pipeline will take 2 years. There's not a quick answer. You're giving us more and more regulations and not giving us simpler solutions.
I think I'll leave it at that.
Max, thank you very much. And great questions all around. So our last presenter is Lori Kemper, and you may have seen her around. She's our Assistant Executive Officer and Principal Engineer of the Lahontan Water Board. Ms. Kemper has worked in practically every program under the board's authority during her almost 30-year tenure at the board. So she is well-versed in all these programs. Ms. Kemper is also a California registered civil engineer. So please welcome Lori Kemper.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here and hanging in there. And my presentation will be brief, and then we'll take a break. My job is to try to just set us up for a productive conversation, and I think that the speakers today have already generated a lot of ideas. I can see people's brains spinning, I think, or at least hearing from different folks in the room. There's definitely a lot of interest in the topic, and I think a lot of, hopefully, creativity, because that's what it's going to take, I think, for us to think outside the box about this. And we're going to dive into more specifically what the regional board can do or could do or is doing. So, you know, obviously this is a large topic, and the reason we brought everybody here today was to educate folks on the biggest and broadest issues associated with climate change and our current drought, and then to really dive into hearing from the public. How can the Water Board do a better job at addressing some of these issues as we move forward into the future? So I'm going to focus today on just some summary. I'm going to summarize some of our existing tools at the Lahontan region and then kind of get us geared up for the roundtable breakout sessions. So many of you know us in our role as regulators, and we have a variety of tools in our toolbox. We issue permits and time schedule orders, and we also set water quality standards. And some of the things, this is just to have you give you some specific concrete examples of things that we could do to help with building resiliency or adapting to change. So, and we have done some of these things already. We've required orders, time schedule orders for example, for wastewater treatment plants to upgrade their infrastructure to deal with failing sewer collection lines, infiltration, taking on stormwater runoff, protecting those structures from 100-year flood events. And we've also required additional treatment in cases where we've seen nitrate pollution problems and things like that. And as was mentioned earlier today, those are the kinds of water quality changes we may see exacerbated by continuing drought. We also have on the books a no net loss of wetlands policy. And mostly, as Max mentioned earlier, we're in a reactive stage where we're trying to prevent further loss. But there's opportunities potentially for the Water Board to get more involved in promoting restoration of wetlands and floodplains to create a more resilient watershed and create additional storage potentially for water. And then specifically in the Lahontan region, we have prohibitions on development in 100-year floodplains. Currently, those prohibitions only exist for the Truckee and Tahoe basins. And we've seen the benefit of having those prohibitions. They've been in place since 1980. And we've seen those watersheds go through some big flood events fairly well because there was not encroachment in those areas. And then lastly, we have grants and loans available, and as Max mentioned, the water bond is hopefully providing additional funds for some of these types of projects. Some other tools we have is we do have a timber waiver that actually regulates vegetation management, and it's a tiered permit that actually makes it really simple for people to conduct defensible space projects, both individual lot owners as well as large landowners that are surrounding power lines or roads or subdivisions. So we're already trying to facilitate and make the regulatory process simpler to reduce the impacts from severe wildfire. We also encourage low-impact development practices in all construction activities to try to increase infiltration and mimic the natural hydrology post-development. The State Board adopted the recycled water policy, which encourages the use of recycled water, and as part of that, the regions down here, the Antelope Valley and Mojave Basin, are completing their salt and nutrient management plans that help us all look out into the future of what we can predict in terms of salt and nutrient increases over time and what we can do about that to try to help us plan for the future. And then lastly, as mentioned in some of the presentations about warmer surface water temperatures, we're already seeing the results of what appears to be the impacts of warmer surface water temperatures and longer growing seasons. In many of our mountain regions, the effect of having a quicker snow melt or an earlier spring runoff, the warmer temperatures throughout the day and the number of days of growing season has contributed to increased algae growth in a lot of our streams and reservoirs and lakes. We're also seeing the habitat changing to facilitate a better environment for invasive species like carp and clams, Asian clams in the Tahoe Basin, and milfoil and other exotic species. So there's an opportunity to do something about that. We actually funded some projects to do that. We also changed our basin plan to facilitate the use of aquatic pesticides where needed to, especially to attack an emergency invasive species problem. And even though we prohibit the use of aquatic pesticides in general, we have exemptions for public health and safety and ecosystem restoration. And we also encourage non-use of pesticides and other creative approaches. So that's all I'm going to say about what we are doing or have been doing. And then on the tables, as mentioned earlier, is this California Adaptive Adaptation Planning Guide. And in there, I just want to highlight a couple of things. So on page 2 of that document is kind of a process to plan for adaptation. And I would argue that we rather quickly covered a number of the early steps today in terms of just identifying the impacts. And specifically, we heard what some of those impacts might be on a regional basis, even though I recognize there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And I think Dr. Zbecki stated it well in terms of saying we're used to kind of dealing with extremes in this region, so maybe we're talking about just doing some of the things we're doing now, but doing them better. And that's really what the workshop after the break when we're meeting at the roundtables is. We're really focused on the 6, 7, 8, and 9 boxes, circles. So today we're really asking you to identify which of the impacts that have been discussed or that you're aware of, which require actions to address them, number 7 is which strategies should be pursued to address the adaptation needs. And then we are looking for input on the priorities. Which one of these strategies should be implemented first? And how can, you know, what are the next steps to try to make that happen? So our focus today is really on 2 questions, which we'll get to later. But they're really, again, focused on this region and what the Water Board can do. In this document, they actually have quite a bit of information, this planning guide, and it's organized by impact sectors. And these are the sectors that are identified. Again, this is for the entire state of California. And as you can see here, there are a number of impacts from climate change, and that was discussed earlier, things about heat and having heat centers, you know, ways to handle those things. We're not going to be talking about some of those today because the Water Board isn't dealing with some of those social impacts. Obviously, we don't need to worry about the ocean and sea level rise. So today, we're really going to be focused on the water management, forest and rangeland management, how to improve biodiversity and habitat or protect it, to be more resilient, and then the issue of infrastructure. So I ask that you think about your ideas maybe in the context of those last four bullets today. And then this slide is not in your materials, and it comes from the US EPA's planning documents, and it was developed as part of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, their 2010 progress report on climate change adaptation. And I just think these are some ideas and principles to think about today when discussing your approaches or your ideas. I think it is really important that we think as integrated as possible across the different sectors, whether it's water or air or municipalities and federal and private property, you know, to really think about how we can integrate our approaches and build partnerships. And the other thing is to really prioritize. I mean, there's a lot of things we could do, and as people have mentioned, there's, you know, really not enough money probably in the world to do everything. So it's really about focusing on the most vulnerable concerns and issues using the best available science. Today we invited a couple of scientists to share some of the latest information, and then to again look at risk management methods and tools to prioritize, so that it's not a one size fits all. You know, we're not looking here today to come up with a new region wide policy that we impose on everyone. We recognize the need for flexibility and the need to really prioritize these higher risk situations. And then where possible to apply ecosystem-based approaches, maximize mutual benefits. And I think that was, Max covered that well in terms of the benefit of investing sometimes. And there's a lot of benefits or win-wins that come out of spending money early to plan better and save us all money and gain some watershed resiliency and protection for human health and the environment. And then to have some sort of monitoring program or tracking to evaluate the progress we're making towards the ideas, the new approaches we're implementing. So today, when we break, you are going to be asked to address these two specific questions. What policies and tools should the Water Board have in place by the year 2040 for dealing with the effects of climate change? And what are the key steps the Board should take to get from the current policies and practices to the desired state in 2040. I think that's my last slide, so there we go. All right, so I think next we're going to have Esther and Doug, I think, facilitate how we're going to do the breakout. So before everybody leaves for a break, let's do that, all right? And then we'll take a break.
Thank you, Lori. Before I hand this off to Esther, what I wanted to do is tell everybody that we're going to go on break here, a 10-minute break in just a little bit. And then when you come back, sit at the table that corresponds to the little number on your name tag. And there will be a number, like the number 10. So sit at that table. And so please just gather all your stuff, and then we'll take it from there. And there will be a small group facilitator at each table. Okay? And then all these material, you are welcome to take that planning guide.